Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is, I think it's Thursday. We are now getting some new numbers in. 2.4 million more Americans file for unemployment insurance, which brings the nine-week total to 38.6 million unemployed Americans. We are also around 94,000 deaths from the coronavirus, on track to top 100,000 possibly by the end of the month. And of course, the president is rage tweeting about so many other things. So joining us on the podcast today, Julia Azari, who is a political science professor from Marquette and a fellow, well, at least for now, Wisconsin. You're in Wisconsin, right?
Yep.
You're here in Milwaukee, correct?
I'm in Milwaukee, yep.
This is so weird because normally I'm the only one who's broadcasting from Wisconsin. So what's it like out there?
Quiet. It's, I mean, probably about the same as it is for you.
See, I'm always afraid that people are going to say, so what are people in Wisconsin saying about X? And then I would have to respond, how would I know? I'm in my basement all day. I don't know what people in Wisconsin, but you know, it's always been hard to explain Wisconsin politics. I think it's becoming harder all the time. I mean, we're the state, you know, that gave America fighting Bob La Follette, but also Joe McCarthy. You know, in the United States Senate, we have Tammy Baldwin, arguably one of the most liberal members, and Ron Johnson, who speaks for himself. So it's, you know, Gaylord Nelson and Scott Walker. So how do you explain Wisconsin? Although I suppose Wisconsin politics is not that much stranger than American politics. I mean, this is a country that elected Barack Obama president and then turned around and elected Donald Trump. So maybe we are kind of a microcosm here. What do you think?
I think so. I've been kind of struggling with this question since about 2010, since it became apparent the state voted pretty overwhelmingly in 2008 for Obama and then for Walker and Ron Johnson in 2010. This big question of kind of, are we a microcosm or are we something different? And I haven't really answered it. I think like my answer is always sort of. And I think one of the elements that scales up to national politics is the urban-rural division, which is very much, this is the frustration that I have explaining Wisconsin politics when I talk to people in the last week or so. I keep seeing people going to the bars in Wisconsin. What is Wisconsin like? And I'm like, I live in Milwaukee. We're under a city order. The bars aren't open here. So, you know, it's very different than it is out in the other parts of the state. And I think that drives our politics. In other ways, I'm not sure that Wisconsin politics exactly scales up. It seems to me that some of the tenor of the partisan warfare here is a little bit different, and maybe even a little bit like some of the figures you described, the historical figures, suggest a much deeper anti-establishment tradition even than the rest of the country. And I think that makes for different politics in a kind of competitive partisan environment.
No, I think those are two really good points here. And in one way, I think that we are a kind of a microcosm of the country because we did model that big sorting out before a lot of people were talking about it. You know, the way in which you have these intensely blue areas side by side with intensely red areas and how there are different states. I mean, the world of Madison, Wisconsin and Milwaukee is completely different than Waukesha. And it is that kind of that balance. So we sorted ourselves out. I feel like we sorted ourselves out a little bit earlier, or maybe we sorted ourselves out before the rest of the country realized how sharply we were self-segregating ourselves by culture and politics.
That's interesting. I would buy that for the southern part of the state.
Yeah.
But I actually think I have this theory, which I don't even know how I would go about testing it. But I've thought about this a lot since the 2016 election and since reading Kathy Kramer's book about rural Wisconsin.
Which is excellent.
Really good book. And I've taught it a couple times, which really gives you a chance to like think about it in new ways. And one of the things that occurred to me is actually that the northwestern part of the state, the Dave Obey part of the state, his congressional district, strikes me as actually an example of slower sorting than the rest of the country, where you had this district that was essentially kind of conservative Democrats, right? Like a lot of unions, people who were not necessarily on board with some of the cultural trends that motivate some of the, like, the urban core of the Democratic Party in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. But we're still Democrats. And then Obie's retirement and kind of this, you know, gradual nationalization of politics, I think, has led to that, group of people, that group of voters sorting into the Republican Party. I don't know if that's true. It's just kind of a theory I've been thinking about that part of the state.
No, that is true. When you think about it, that this was a district that was represented by Dave Obie. He was liberal, but he was, you know, in that old sort of New Deal style of liberalism. And now it's one of the most intensely Republican districts. It went from Dave Obie to Sean Duffy, another one of these contrasts. So you also touched on something else, which I guess is kind of always in the back of my mind here. We used to have kind of a mavericky streak in our politics. And I wrote about this a little bit yesterday. And, you know, part of my real disappointment with somebody like Ron Johnson is that he holds the seat that was once held by William Proxmire, who in so many ways, at least to me, feels like kind of the quintessential Wisconsin maverick politician. He was a Democrat, but he really marched to his own drummer. And we had a long tradition of these very sort of independent members of Congress. And so to watch them morph into partisan foot soldiers is somewhat depressing. But there was that kind of quirky, mavericky streak in Wisconsin politics. And I think that, you know, Russ Feingold had a little bit of that, but that seems so last decade now, doesn't it?
It does. If, you know, even further back than that, in some ways. I don't have a firm answer for this. When Feingold lost to Ron Johnson in 2010, I had a student who was doing a real sort of close read on Feingold's career for it, an independent study. So I want to give credit to that student for this insight. But he felt, and I thought this made a lot of sense, he felt like Feingold had started his career as a maverick and had kind of over time been portrayed, and particularly given the Obama administration at the time, had been sort of portrayed as just another Obama Democrat, and having lost that edge made him lose his political credibility. I think that's right. And I think that something very weird has happened with this notion of mavericky outsider politics, because it still exists, but now it's gotten merged into partisan conflict. And I think there's two things going on there. And one is that national politics is now just that, right? What the political bread and butter of people who were able to be party mavericks was in part their knowledge of and their service to their district. And that could take different forms, but it was a kind of localized politics of, well, this person really understands and represents who we are. And sometimes that goes along with the party, but many times it doesn't. And that can sustain a political career. And now politics is much more nationalized, and it's just not, I think, possible if you're a senator or a member of the House, in most cases, to really separate yourself from whoever the most prominent symbols of the national party are. The other thing, no, I think,
that's,
yeah,
that's
go
a
ahead.
Great point. No, that is a great point, and it explains the uniformity when you think about, you know, how different these constituencies are around the country. You would expect to have a diversity of voices, but you don't. There is kind of a flattening because of the nationalization of our politics.
I mean, the sort of corollary to that is, I think that politics, is that debate, the national debate, has become much more values oriented. And every sort of fight about any political issue quickly becomes about these underlying moral values, underlying symbols. And that, you know, that makes it harder, I think, for mavericks to stake out that value-based politics. Like, that used to be kind of novel. You could bring that into the conversation. Now it's like, no, that's just everywhere. You have to come up with a new thing to look different and mavericky and distinct.
Okay, so I want to talk about the Veep stakes, because I know you've been talking about that a lot. But before we do that, I want to talk about the vote by mail blow up yesterday, because it was so weird. It was so strange. The president tweeting out this attack on Michigan. He got almost all the facts wrong. They didn't mail out ballots. They mailed out applications. It was not illegal. It was completely legal. And in fact, what they were doing in Michigan is being done by a number of states around the country, including by states that are run by Republicans. But it was really extraordinary that the president felt the need to escalate it to the point that he was threatening to retaliate against Michigan. And parenthetically, on a day in which they had this massive disaster, he retaliated against Michigan by withholding funds because they were encouraging more vote by mail. So in Trump world, that sends out the bat signal that we hate, right? That we hate vote by mail, except when we do it. So can we like sort of break down what's going on with the politics of voting by mail? Because, you know, Donald Trump himself in the last election voted by mail. So that's good. But when people in Michigan and Wisconsin do it, that's bad. Help me understand this.
Oh man.
Right.
Yeah, this is the struggle of people who work on presidential communication and kind of explain Trump's tweets. Well, okay. I mean, there's sort of two theories of Trump tweets, right? And one is that they're just sort of like completely fired off, you know, not thought through, and that's why you get all these inconsistencies and these sorts of, you know, inaccuracies. The other theory, and this is a theory that's, I think, pretty popular among a wide range of political scientists, is that this is an effort to delegitimize the election before it happens. And so you sow a lot of doubt about the administration of the election. You sow doubt not just about who's voting. So you saw some of that in 2016, and that was also not new. Kind of sowing doubt about vote fraud and illegal undocumented individuals voting in the election, things like that, things that don't have any evidence for them being true. This kind of takes it to the next level. And I think maybe you sort of kind of start to strain credulity with some of the stories about people voting illegally. So then with vote by mail, you start to not only call into question the integrity of the ballot box, but the intentions of the people administering elections, which is like a group of people nobody thought about until 2 months ago. And now that becomes another institution to attack, right? These people, yes. Public servants in the Midwest, right? Who are trying to figure out how can people vote safely in a pandemic and working under uncertain conditions and resource constraints. And so that to me is sort of like leveling that up to sow doubts about the election results. I think that's a plausible explanation.
Well, so Amy Walter tweeted out this morning, Trump's attacks on vote by mail are not meant to dissuade people from voting. In fact, his campaign and other Republicans are actively engaged in vote by mail organizing. It is about sowing doubt about the legitimacy of certain types of voters, rural vote by mail, okay, urban illegitimate. So this does play on a number of different levels, and it does seem like he is setting himself up to challenge or cast doubt on the legitimacy of it, of the November election, which of course has long-term consequences. And I talked with Benjamin Wittes about this yesterday, but I guess the anxiety on the part of Republicans, which is less and less subtle all the time, about that it's somehow bad to make it easy for people to vote. I mean, it feels like to me like they're saying the quiet part out loud more and more, which is that if a lot of people can vote, if we make it really easy, there's no way we can win elections, which is a rather strange position to. I mean, is that the hill they want to die on?
Yeah, I mean, I I hope not. I have a real concern about this, not just about the delegitimization of elections or like this, the notion of we need to make it a little harder to vote because the wrong people are voting is quite old, right? And goes back to the progressive era, and the creation of voter registration. So I think that's, it really plays on these older traditions. And of course, we also have a shameful tradition of disenfranchising African-American voters in various ways. So that's all, there's a playbook for that. My concern is, it does kind of lie with this notion of thinking about if we have two major parties in this country and one of them thinks that if more people vote, they can't win, or that their electoral success is dependent on, these very specific kinds of policies around voter access. That, if that is true, is actually pretty concerning, because one of the things that I kind of see happening here in Wisconsin and other parts of the country is a move from this sort of polarized, closely matched politics, which is very ugly, but it's also very competitive and gets a lot of people involved and I think has some upsides, to a kind of minoritarian politics where there's one party that's dependent on a shrinking voter base. I listened to your piece with Thomas Patterson about that a couple days ago. And seeks to, rather than to grow the voter base, to consolidate minoritarian, minority rule. A lot of people have been writing about this minority rule concept, and that's really, to me, that's really the major concern right now.
Well, and this has become this was a major theme that I've heard, at least in certain elements, about the whole issue of immigration, that if we allowed too many immigrants, they would vote Democrat. And this is one of the reasons why we needed to crack down on illegal immigration or legal immigration, which, again, is kind of a strange concession belief that if the franchise is extended, we can't come up with an agenda to get them to vote for us. Okay, so you want to talk about the Veep stakes? Should we talk about that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Oh, okay. So Kellyanne Conway came out of the White House and had this to say about Joe Biden's selection process.
You've seen the long short list of Joe Biden's VP choices. They all happen to be female. He sounds like a co-ed at the end of a frat party. I need a woman.
Yeah, this is deep thinking from Kellyanne Conway. So give me your sense of where we're at here, because to me, you have the partisans, you have people who are really boosting Stacey Abrams. She had that glowing over the top, I think, profile in the Washington Post. There's clearly a big push for Elizabeth Warren, who is obviously interested in changing her position on Medicare for All to make herself more palatable. A lot of folks think that Amy Klobuchar would be able to appeal to more. Well, just give me your sense how this plays out and how you think Joe Biden is thinking about it.
So I think this is the way this plays out is a little bit challenging, because the Democrats have right now kind of a dilemma, which is, do you nominate someone for vice president who, for whatever reason, would not probably be at the top of the ticket, knowing that this person might end up in the presidency in one way or another? Or, at the same time, you also kind of want to reach out to different groups within the party, and some of those groups are demographic and some are ideological. Those two things are not obviously compatible. I was thinking about that specifically with regard to Stacey Abrams, who I think most people would agree is probably, is a little early in her career for a presidential nomination, would like to see her in a higher office before thinking about her in that context, but has been widely floated as VP. And you also kind of see that with, I think, some of the, this is maybe a more controversial statement, but I think that's also maybe sort of true with regard to someone like Elizabeth Warren, right? That kind of like, do we put this person on the ticket who ran for president and wasn't successful? Would she reach, would she bring in certain kinds of constituencies? Would she be the kind of person that you would want in an administration, kind of being the policy idea person, which is how she was trying to sell herself in 2018. I think these things are sort of, you know, this is sort of complicated. Often you see this, like, ideologically, you have this balancing choice. Do you reach out to the rest of the party with your VP pick and try to sort of use this as a consolation prize, which maybe is a very transparent strategy at this point. Or do you kind of consolidate the ideological project? And that was what, in the last debate, the last Democratic debate, that was kind of what Sanders said he would do, which made sense. And also, it doesn't have to be an ideological project on the extremes, right? That's kind of what Bill Clinton did in 92 also.
Yeah, the two wings. So let's kind of break this down into four little buckets here. That Joe Biden's got to decide, does he want to choose somebody in the traditional way who might help him with the Electoral College, say a Gretchen Whitmer or maybe Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota? That's one. Number two, does he pick someone, and for lack of a better term, the identity politics, understanding that in order to win, he's really got to mobilize African-American voters and go for, I mean, Jonathan Capehart is making this argument that if you want African-Americans in Philadelphia and Detroit and Milwaukee to turn out, you need to have an African-American. Do you pick somebody what you just were describing for the ideological balance to motivate the progressive wing of the party? So again, you know, Electoral College, I'm trying to break this down, Electoral College appeal, racial ethnic appeal, ideological appeal. Or when you're sitting in that room, do you say, I'm Joe Biden and I'm 180 years old, I have to pick somebody who can be the president of the United States tomorrow? Now, right. There's obviously a lot of overlap here, but more than ever before, people are going to be looking at that person and saying, can that person be president if Joe Biden, A, does not finish out his term, or B, is a one-term president and therefore becomes the heir apparent? So, again, they're not all mutually exclusive, but they are kind of stark, aren't they? So how do you sort this out? How do you think he's going to, how will he sort this out?
I mean, I think there's two ways that the VP picks get sorted out. And one is a sort of by committee, where the party actors and the vice presidential selection committee have a lot of say, and it becomes kind of a checkbox situation. And I've written a little bit about that with my colleague, William Adler, at Northeastern Illinois, evidence about how the party kind of does it, and they will have a checklist, right? This person needs to bring in this constituency or that constituency, which again for Democrats is a real challenge because they do have this kind of group identity party. So, you know, that's its own challenge. But I think the other way that this gets resolved is that the presidential candidate understands, okay, I need to pick someone who, I think in Biden's case, he understands what his statement about the woman. He understands that in 2020, if you have a group that's supposed to be representative in some way and it only has one gender or it only has one race, that you're sending a signal that you just didn't look at every qualified person. And you can agree or disagree with that, but I think that's sort of the logic of that statement. So you understand you have some parameters, right? Like you have to pick someone who's not going to completely alienate your core base. But I actually think some of the better vice presidential picks come from the candidate sort of understands who they need and who they have chemistry with. And that takes care of some of the electoral stuff and it takes care of some of the governing stuff. And that's not very scientific. And I'll probably have to turn in my political science card. But that's kind of my read on it.
Okay, just stepping back for a moment, because you are the political scientist. When was the last time a vice presidential pick actually made any difference in the November election?
I think there's certainly some evidence that Sarah Palin did in 2008.
Really?
Yes.
Positively or negatively?
Negatively. Although it was, so it's mixed. And here I'm going off of, there was a piece in the Washington Post that writes up some of this research. And then there's a recent book that's like hot off the presses. I think it came out yesterday about running mates. And those, that research finds that it did have some impact among conservatives, that it was a signal to conservatives that McCain, who was viewed with some suspicion by movement conservatives, that, you know, that he was taking that wing of the party seriously. There's no evidence that Palin improved the ticket's fortunes with women. And I do think that there's evidence that her seeming unprepared, it wasn't so much her, right? It wasn't so much people were voting for or against her, as that it illustrated, and this is an argument in this new book, it illustrated something about McCain, that he wasn't taking this seriously, or he didn't have good judgment. And those are serious accusations for a presidential candidate, and that, you know, the Veep stakes kind of reflects what the candidate is about and what the candidate values.
This is really interesting to me, because you could really do a case study in the worst vice presidential choice ever. You know, that's just pushing out Sarah Palin for exactly the reasons you said, and then sort of reverse engineer how did we get to that point? What was the decision making process? The sort of Hail Mary pass, and convincing themselves that somebody who was so clearly and manifestly unqualified should be the vice president. I mean, so these things can go very, very wrong, can't they? I mean, particularly if there's kind of that whiff in the room that we have to do something bold and dramatic.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. And I think it was some of that context, the idea of doing something bold and dramatic, as well as the story, which as far as I know is true, that McCain wanted to pick Joe Lieberman and he was told he couldn't.
Yeah. That is true.
And I think that would have been a more strategic pick in a lot of ways. It might have alienated the conservative base. I'm not sure how that group of voters would have responded in 2008 and stayed home. I don't think they would have voted for Obama. But, but I think the Lieberman pick would have just been more kind of true to McCain's political project, and that would have come out in various ways. So I think it would have been a more strategic pick.
Conservatives would have lost their minds if he would have done that. Now, I'm guessing you're going to disagree with this. If thinking through the worst choice ever being McCain's choice of Sarah Palin, maybe one of the better choices, and I'm probably going to regret saying this because I'm just sort of thinking about this as we're talking about it, George W. Bush deciding that he would go with Dick Cheney on the basis of who's qualified to be president. And I understand how people are going to react to that. But that choice made no sense in terms of a lot of the other qualifications. He wasn't sexy. He didn't appeal to any particular powerful wing of the party. He did absolutely nothing for Bush in terms of electoral politics. So I was thinking of Cheney in the back of my mind when I'm thinking about Joe Biden, thinking about somebody who is so immensely qualified that their credentials wouldn't be challenged, because in many ways, Cheney was the polar opposite of Palin. I mean, the guy had been around forever. She had been around for about 5 minutes. You hate that analogy, don't you?
No, I don't. I was actually thinking about Cheney earlier this week and kind of like separating aside policy, you know, how we might evaluate people's different policy positions or what they did in office. Was Cheney a good vice presidential pick? And I do remember this because it was so surprising, because Cheney was the chair of the selection committee.
Yeah.
selected himself. And he just kind of wasn't on the radar for all the reasons that you've said. I do remember at the time, I have a really vivid memory at the time of some, you know, pundit saying something along the lines, this was sort of in the voice, I think, of George H.W. Bush, of, you know, it's okay, son, you can drive the car as long as Uncle Dick is in the passenger
seat. Right.
But and I actually think there's something to that, right?
He gave gravitas. Remember, gravitas was the big thing back then.
Right. I do remember that. But here's something you don't hear about as much, and this is something my co-author and I have kind of thought about trying to assess, which is how much does the opponent shape the VP pick? How much, you know, how does that aspect of the competitive environment shape what you're thinking about? So Bush is running. He's not running right against Barack Obama. He's running against Al Gore and Joe Lieberman. And oh, I guess the Republicans picked first. But right, he's running against Al Gore. So like the charisma bar isn't that high. I think that may have been part of it. And I think it is important to note that election was really close. So it's not like we can definitively say, well, Cheney was a very strategic pick. But I do think that for people who care about policy, and particularly maybe for defense-minded Republicans, it was a reassuring pick. I don't know that Dick Cheney, appealed to any swing voters necessarily, but
yeah,
but it didn't look bad.
Well, and you could also argue that was a very consequential choice given the foreign policy influence that he had over the next 8 years. So going back to Sarah Palin, speaking of consequential choice, the more I think about what's happened to the Republican Party and the conservative movement, the more I keep coming back to that choice, that was really, I won't say a turning point, but it was certainly an inflection point that you would bring sort of a populist like Sarah Palin, who was in many ways kind of a proto-Trump, and her appeal, even after the election, was an indication of things that were going on in the Republican Party. I actually, in my other life, at an event, I had to introduce Sarah Palin, and it was this big, large group. In fact, it was in Wisconsin. It was, what year would it have been? It would have been 2009, when it was pretty obvious that 2010 would be a Republican year, but she turned out this massive crowd. It was a Wisconsin State Fair in West Allis. And I was sitting there on the stage listening to her, and I had this sort of, chilling moment thinking, if she ran for president, she would just roll through the primaries, and that would be a disaster. That would be horrible. But she'd kind of captured that populist, real America, I don't need to know any stuff kind of vibe, and people were eating it up. So in a lot of ways, she paved the way for Donald Trump. So these decisions are not just sort of throwaways, are they?
They're not. And actually, I think that the Cheney decision is also really critical there, where it's like it wasn't obvious at all in 2000 what his role would look like a very short time later. I think I absolutely agree with the Palin assessment. There was some activity on Twitter about this as well, where people were talking about her role on that ticket. I think she has kind of this amazing way of turning phrases and speeches which to me is actually much more compelling and thought provoking than the way Trump does it. She said something once about needing a professor of law or needing a commander in chief, not a professor of law in the White House. And I used that on my presidency midterm for years, had my students assess that difference and whether those are really separate things. The other thing I think she did, though, was she really highlighted the sort of the ways in which the messaging that came out of that element of the conservative movement, like that was a messaging that was just about electoral politics and had been very carefully and generally cordoned off from the governing and the national level serious stuff. The nomination of Sarah Palin for vice president broke that dam between the more establishment wing of the party and then letting this more populist wing closer to national politics and power. But what it also did was really expose that rift and expose the degree to which there is a separation between people like Dick Cheney and the Bushes and the element of the conservative base that had been receptive to these more cultural and populist messages for many years.
Okay, so I want to keep going back to the Biden choice and using Sarah Palin as kind of a benchmark of what not to do. She was a first-term governor of Alaska, so on paper her credentials were awfully weak, but that really wasn't her problem, right? I mean, so Stacey Abrams, her background is she's just a former state representative. Pete Buttigieg is not in the race; he was only the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. But for her, the problems of Sarah Palin ran a lot deeper than the resume, didn't they?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think that there are people in the throughout the country who are governors, who are mayors of smaller cities and towns, who are very insightful and very qualified. And they might need some preparation before ascending to an office like the vice presidency, but they could get there. The problem with Palin very much was this more intangible or difficult to measure quality where she just wasn't up to speed on fairly standard fundamental issues of national and international politics, and she didn't appear to be interested in getting up to speed on those issues. So I think experience is not a perfect marker.
No, I think that's a key point, is not only was she just not up to speed, she didn't have that curiosity of mind that you would hope to have. And in that way, I think she's kind of a precursor to Donald Trump. Okay, so do you want to handicap what the Democratic Veep States looks like right now? Who you think would be the top three people to really, really keep our eye on?
I honestly don't really know, because I don't know what some of these behind the scenes strategies have been or will be. I will say I did actually correctly predict both Biden and Palin in 2008.
Ooh, really?
The Democrats.
How did you do that? Because neither of them was obvious.
No, I don't think so. So I don't really remember how I came to either of these predictions, but I do have an email in June of 2008 that I sent to my husband. We had just started dating, saying, I've been looking into the governor of Alaska, and I really think she has all the qualities that McCain needs on the ticket. That was June. And then Biden, I mean, I think Biden was somewhat more standard in terms of a pick, right? He also had all of the things. He was older. He had foreign policy experience in the Senate. I thought those were going to be the sorts of things. He was very, very many years of experience. And I thought he was going to bring that. So I think Biden is in a tough position, because the two things he needs are two things that are very challenging to get. It's one thing to be a relatively inexperienced presidential candidate like Obama and go, okay, I need a long-term senator. It's another thing to be the candidate who has a lot of experience, like, okay, I need some fresh blood. And then you run into the problem of, who is fresh but experienced enough, who is not going to embarrass you with secret, lack of intellectual curiosity or inability to stay on message or any number of problems. That's really challenging. And also that Biden, maybe kind of related to that, I think people are looking to this pick to add some excitement to the ticket. And there's a perception that Biden was a fairly weak party front runner. And he doesn't generate excitement among key constituencies in the party. So specifically, I think younger African-Americans, he does better with older African-Americans, and Latinos who are more excited, more likely to support Bernie Sanders. So he needs somebody to kind of generate some enthusiasm among these key constituencies. And generating attention and enthusiasm is a very risky game, because ideally you want the vice president to sort of, wear beige and do the talking points. And so you need someone who's going to generate that excitement and draw media attention and kind of have a gamble that they don't have a downside. I don't know.
The excitement pick gets you Sarah Palin. The safer pick gets you somebody who's not going to do it. I actually always think that Biden has been underestimated. Basement Joe is still running 11 points ahead in the Quinnipiac poll and has had this consistent lead. And everybody keeps talking about enthusiasm. I don't know. I don't know what else the Democrats need to get enthusiastic other than running against Donald Trump. That should be motivation. That should be motivation enough, shouldn't it? How many people are actually going to say, I wasn't going to vote, but I'm going to vote because of the vice presidential choice? I don't know. But then that's not up to me. No, there's a couple of interesting things going on. I was going to say in the Republican side, but I want to focus here on the Democratic side. Joe Biden has really gone out of his way to appeal to the progressive wing. He's created all of these task forces. which have representatives from Bernie World, including people like AOC, and also is, you know, clearly trying to appeal to Elizabeth, some of the Elizabeth Warren supporters. There's, of course, always the danger that you might go too far left when you don't have to, but there's clearly an effort to build bridges to the left, which I think is interesting. It makes me wonder whether he really is thinking of appointing somebody, naming somebody like an Amy Klobuchar to the ticket. But on this issue of motivation, this is where it gets so complicated, because Elizabeth Warren is, you know, kind of a, you know, a segment of the media darling, but I don't know that she excites the kinds of voters that you just described, the younger African Americans, Latino voters.
I think that's right. I mean, I think part of the reason that she didn't do better in the primaries is because she didn't really break out of that, out of a pretty specific segment, narrow of the electorate, and she's popular with white voters, with college educated voters. And yeah, I think that's right. And I think you can easily find lots of positions, lots of opinion pieces on the left suggesting that, or at least in the kind of broader Democratic sphere. Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things that's going on in the Democratic Party is that it's not, the appeal of the progressive wing of the party is somewhat unclear, right? You see these successes with Bernie Sanders, particularly in 2016, and then early on in this cycle, but not really much later on. Warren's candidacy that generated, like you said, a lot of kind of media attention, has been very popular among academics and intellectuals, but maybe not much out of that. But it is clear, though, that the progressive wing of the party is to some degree setting the conversational agenda. And that was really evident, I think, in the like 20,000 debates. And that was, I remember my biggest complaint as a political person was I was watching too many debates.
They were awful.
It was a lot. It was a lot.
It was a lot.
But I could leave my house then. So whatever, trade-offs. But I think that's my read on the progressive dynamic. And the other relevant data point there is interpreting the 2016 loss. And there's a lot of different types of arguments that one could make about why the Democrats lost that election, including that they didn't lose the popular vote, of course. But
yeah,
one of them, I think, is insufficient outreach to the progressive wing of the party. And so it makes sense to try to cover that problem. I also think, though, like, we're talking a lot about candidates, and really the relevant thing for the 2020 election is that we're looking at, what, 20% unemployment, possibly. And I certainly hope that that's not true in November, but the outlook is pretty bleak. And if it's mostly a referendum on the status quo, it's not really going to matter who the vice president is.
Well, that's kind of my gut sense as well, is that there are certain fundamentals which have just not gone away, have not disappeared. I'm actually looking for something that Joe Biden said yesterday. You know, he had a virtual town hall meeting here in Wisconsin, or in Milwaukee, which of course means it didn't really happen, but He gave an interview to one of the local television stations. I don't know if you saw this. I think it was WISN television. And they asked him about, you know, Ron Johnson, and Ron Johnson pushing through a subpoena for some records involving Hunter Biden. Mm-hmm. And Biden's response was very interesting. You know, this would be much more effective if I actually had this in front of me. But he said, you know, what, you know, this is a distraction. And what does this have to do with Wisconsin? Why is Ron Johnson not pushing to help small businesses, put people back to work and everything? Why is he, you know, doing this sort of thing? And I watched that. I mean, I read about that, and I thought, oh, where have I just heard that? And I just heard that on the Lincoln Project ad that they're running against Martha McSally down in Arizona, where they just pound her. Why has she gone so full Trump? Why is she not doing something about, you know, what's happening with the economy, with, you know, with small businesses and unemployment? Why is she not fighting for, you know, working Arizonans? And what struck me is right now, Joe Biden seems to be taking his some of his talking points from this Never Trumper group. It's an interesting dynamic that some of these Never Trumpers are actually being more aggressive and more effective right now than the Democrats. But the good news, I guess, was that Joe Biden was paying attention because this was exactly what he was talking about. So who's not on my radar screen, our radar screen, on the VP? You've looked at this more closely than I have. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, is it going to be Elizabeth Warren? Is it going to be Amy Klobuchar, Gretchen Whitmer, Stacey Abrams, Kamala Harris? Is there anybody else that might be in this mix that didn't mention?
The person that I am somewhat surprised not to have heard more about is fairly new Representative Katie Porter of California, who is
very impressive.
Someone who clearly kind of knows her stuff. She's kind of an Elizabeth Warren type. And I think she's sort of, I haven't thought a lot about, you know, what would be strategic, because I think that's a moving target. But I do think that she sort of would potentially be able to straddle the divide of being a relative newcomer, but also someone who has, you know, eminently qualified and can demonstrate those qualifications, and who's kind of interesting, but like not so interesting that she'll overshadow the nominee, or draw a lot of media attention that will kind of turn into a circus. That's someone I'm a little surprised not to hear more about her.
Huh. Yeah, she is wicked smart. What about Val Demings?
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about her, and I don't know.
Former police chief, right? But a first term congresswoman. That's where I think that even though she's very, very attractive as a candidate, I wonder whether or not she would pass that "Are you ready to be commander in chief" test, because that's got to come up this time. There's no question about it. So there are others. The other point, and you made this earlier, the one thing you do not want with a vice presidential nominee is somebody who is going to steal the spotlight or become a distraction. And so it helps if they've been pre-vetted in a certain way, which is why there's that long tradition of going for people who've actually run for president, who've had that experience, who've gone through at least part of that mill. Which, you know, makes me continue to come back to somebody like a Kamala Harris, who frankly does check an awful lot of boxes.
She does. And she has some real good moments, I think, in, you know, public speaking. She's very comfortable in that arena, and had some memorable moments in some of the early Senate hearings early in the Trump years. I mean, in some ways, you know, sure, why not? In other ways, it's possible that she would have liabilities in the same way that led to her not being a more successful presidential candidate. I think that she, you know, she seems like she should sort of have this broad appeal. She maybe was kind of everybody's second choice, but she really ran into issues on the left because of her record as California's attorney general. And it didn't actually seem like she, you know, got a lot of excitement out of the constituencies that she was supposed to. So maybe that works fine for a vice president, but it's also possible that if the Biden campaign is trying to reach out to what they see as a progressive wing of the party, that Harris will seem like a kind of not the right pick. I mean, that's obviously true of lots of possible candidates. That'd be true of Klobuchar also.
Okay, so I'm going to switch a little bit to what's going on in Trump world here, because I said I think there was a couple of interesting things happening on, you know, in the campaign. There's a really interesting piece in the Daily Beast where they quote people who are close to the Trump campaign, who I think are accurately saying that one of the top goals now of Trump world is to turn Joe Biden into Hillary Clinton, is that they want to Clintonize Joe Biden. My first reaction to that was, isn't this a classic example of generals fighting the last war? Because, and there is something about Trump that has this nostalgia that he wants to run against Barack Obama. He wants to make Obama the issue. And if he can't run against Obama, he just wants to relive 2016 all over again. But, you know, and I know that they're going to throw an awful lot at Joe Biden, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of, you know, smoke out there. But Joe Biden is not Hillary Clinton, is he?
No, I mean, he's not. I think it, you know, Hillary Clinton had, you know, had 25 years of tropes against her that were out there in the public discourse. She also had the baggage of three different presidential administrations. Her Iraq war vote made her in some ways implicated in some of the unpopular decisions of the Bush administration. And of course, she was closely connected to her husband's administration, and she was in the Obama administration, right? So she had a lot of political baggage. And obviously, there's the gender picture, which we can debate about how much that might have mattered. There are a lot of differences, I think, in terms of kind of where they stand in the party and what wing of the Democratic Party they represent. That's similar. And right. Anyone who's been in politics for a long time, there's going to be some baggage.
Well, but the baggage is you're right, and I think that a lot of Democrats underestimated, you know, what it meant that she had basically, there'd been 20 years of marinating Hillary hate before the 2016 election. She really did occupy almost a unique position because there was so much, the role that she played in the 1990s, the scandals involving Bill Clinton, the whole thing with Hillary Care. And then, as you point out, some of the baggage that she also then brought from the Obama years. But you mentioned this. What is your sense of how important gender was in that? Because there's two things I'm looking at this. Number one, people generally don't hate Joe Biden the way they hated Hillary Clinton. Joe Biden is widely liked as a persona. And a lot of politics, we often assume politics is about ideas and about positions and about position papers. But a lot of it boils down to do people like you or do they not like you? They like Joe Biden. They didn't like Hillary Clinton. How much of that was about gender, do you think?
I think there is definitely an argument for it, and there's evidence showing that various sexism attitudes, as measured by political psychologists, made a difference. At the same time, I think you have a female candidate on the top of the ticket for the Democratic Party in 2016. Gender is baked into that 20 years or more of baggage, and it's also maybe even baked into the way that she's affiliated deeply with all sorts of status quo, and she still won the popular vote.
Yeah, she did.
So I've had this argument lots of times with people that about what can be drawn from that about different, about gender, about anything. And I think it's actually worth noting that of all the candidates, of all the tickets we've had in the 21st century of people who were not, Christian, white men, right? You have Gore Lieberman, you have two times with Obama, you have Clinton 2016, what do all these tickets have in common? They all won the popular vote. I think that your electoral college strategy is always something that, tickets always need to pay attention to their electoral college strategy. And maybe the takeaway of those stories is that that's especially true when you have someone of an underrepresented demographic. But, so I think that women candidates in the presidential realm face different problems. And I think that widely it's believed that that was part of the problem for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and that affected female candidates in 2020. But I actually don't think that it's as much of a liability as some people do.
Yeah, I think, but I think that the attempt to make Biden into Hillary Clinton, I think it shows the lack of confidence, the lack of imagination on the part of some of the folks that are running this campaign, particularly when you're running as an incumbent. This, of course, is the challenge of you're Donald Trump and you run grievance campaigns. How do you run a grievance campaign while you are the incumbent president? How do you pull off what you pulled off 4 years ago when everything is right there? But of course, as we learned 4 years ago, we don't know as much as we think we know. Julia Azari, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
Any time. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.